We come then to our second lecture in the life of the Apostle Paul, and we want to look at his background and his early life. I had a good piece of advice when I was about 12 years of age from one of my Latin teachers. It's advice that's useful for writing, for lecturing, for preaching sermons, and for many other things. His advice was, begin at the beginning, go on to the end, and then stop. You'd be amazed how often that advice is ignored by people who write and preach. But we want in Paul's life to begin at the beginning. And in his case, that beginning is conception. For that is his own starting point as he reflects upon his life. In Galatians 1:15, he speaks of God who set me apart from my mother's womb. I don't know why the New International Version in the main body of the text translates that as set me apart from birth. The two phrases are not synonymous, and the Greek's quite clear. Paul was set apart, he says, by God from his mother's womb. And the verb which he uses for set apart is the verb aphorizo. Aphorizo or aphorizo, which means to appoint or to separate for a special purpose. To appoint or to separate for a special purpose. It is used in Acts 13:2. The Holy Spirit said, set apart for me Barnabas and Saul for the work to which I have called them. It is found in Romans chapter 1 and verse 1. Paul, a called apostle, set apart for the gospel of God. Aph horismenos, passive participle. So he says here that God set him apart, appointed him or separated him for a special purpose. Kittel points out that this verb is used in the Septuagint to translate the Hebrew parush, P-A-R-U-S-H in English letters, which by many is thought to be connected with the word Pharisee, a separated one. That's an interesting line of thought. Is Paul making a point there? Saul the Pharisee was indeed a true Pharisee. Saul the separated one, as he looks back, was indeed a true separated one. Separated by God for a specific purpose from the first moment of his existence. God set me apart. God made me as Pharisee from my mother's womb. Now, for what purpose was Paul set apart? There's a well-known parallel mentioned in the commentators with God's words to Jeremiah. Jeremiah 1:5, and Galatians 1:15 is certainly a reflection on Jeremiah 1:5. Before I formed you in the womb, I knew you. Before you were born, I set you apart. I appointed you as a prophet to the nations, or to the Gentiles. So Jeremiah was set apart in the womb, before he was formed in the womb, and he was set apart as a prophet, and he was set apart as a prophet to the nations. Now Paul is certainly reflecting on this passage as he speaks in Galatians 1:5. As Jeremiah was appointed before birth as a prophet to the nations, so Paul tells us in the next verse of Galatians how the God who set him apart was pleased to reveal his Son in me so that I might preach him among the Gentiles, preach him among the nations. The parallel is very close. There is, I believe, an even more interesting and yet often neglected Old Testament parallel with the servant passage of Isaiah 49. In this passage, the speaker is the Messiah, and yet not just the Messiah. For the words spoken also apply to the Messiah's people, his body, the true Israel, every faithful servant of the Lord. E.J. Young comments on this passage, it is a designation of the true people of God, the whole body of the redeemed, as members under the head, the Messiah. So in Isaiah 49, we have the Messiah speaking. We have also the Messiah speaking, as it were, on behalf of his body and as applying to his body. And we might consider verses 1 to 3 and verses 5 and 6. Think of these in the light of Paul being set apart from his mother's womb. Listen to me, you islands. Hear this, you distant nations. Before I was born, the Lord called me. From my birth, he has made mention of my name. He made my mouth like a sharpened sword. In the shadow of his hand, he hid me. He made me into a polished arrow and concealed me in his quiver. And now the Lord says, he who formed me in the womb to be his servant, to bring Jacob back to him and gather Israel to himself, it is too small a thing for you to be my servant to restore the tribes of Jacob and bring back those of Israel I have kept. I will also make you a light for the Gentiles, that you may bring my salvation to the ends of the earth. I believe the echo in Galatians is also very clear. He's not just reflecting on Jeremiah, he's reflecting on the Isaiah passage. Paul sees himself as a servant of the Lord, participating in the mission of the Messiah, appointed to preach the gospel to the Jews first, and then to the Gentiles, to the ends of the earth. And you can see how beautifully that Isaiah passage fits into Paul's conception of his ministry. God's appointment was no last-minute affair. His electing hand was upon Paul's life from conception. And we ought, therefore, to be able to trace in Paul's heredity, environment, and early upbringing the marks of God's providential working. We should be able to discern the fingerprints of the great potter as he prepares and shapes this vessel for his purposes and glory. And so we can. Because God was forming a man who could take the Jewish faith to the Greeks and to the Romans. Someone who could understand and communicate with those three very different races and cultures. And in Paul, he had designed such a man. Philip Schaff says, he combined in himself the three great nationalities of the ancient world and was endowed with all the natural qualifications for a universal apostleship. So in this lecture, we're going to look at his Greek background, his Roman background, and his Jewish background, for these were all essential in preparing him for his future ministry. I could say before we begin to look at his Greek background that the date of Paul's birth is not known. There is a very persistent tradition from the early church that he served God for 35 years and died in Rome in 67 AD at the age of 68. Now, if there is any substratum of fact in that tradition, and perhaps we shouldn't in our Protestantism just airily wipe all these traditions out, if there is any substratum of fact in that tradition, That would mean that he was born about 1 BC, converted about 32-33 AD. And there's nothing in what we know from the New Testament data to make that at all unlikely. If that's not absolutely accurate, I would say it's pretty close. To sort of set the historical picture, Paul lived during the reign of five different Caesars. He was born in the reign of Augustus. He grew to manhood during Tiberius and Caligula. He spent his middle age during Claudius and his old age during Nero. So those were the five emperors who ruled the empire during his lifetime. To again root it in history, when Paul was a middle-aged man, the Roman legions invaded Britain and founded the city of London. So that's a sort of a contemporary event. As an old man, he may have heard of the revolt in Britain under Boadicea, the English queen, which was happening about that time. What other figures could we mention? Josephus would have been about 30 at the time of Paul's death. Philo of Alexandria would have been about 20 years older than Paul. And the Roman writers, Livy, the historian, Ovid, the poet, would have died when Paul was a young man. Seneca and Pliny would have been more or less his contemporaries. So he was living at that stage in history. Let's look first then at his Greek background. He was born, as we know, in the city of Tarsus, in the province of Cilicia. He refers to it in Acts 21:39 as no mean city or no ordinary city. I suppose we're all prejudiced in favour of the town or city where we were born, but I think Paul was not being unduly chauvinistic when he praised his own city, for it was a very notable and influential city. It's situated in Southeast Asia, 12 miles from the coast, on the banks of the Cydnus River, C-Y-D-N-U-S. It was a fortified city from very ancient times. It was a trade route. Just north of Tarsus you had the Taurus Mountains, T-A-U-R-U-S, and there was only one pass through those mountains. A little chiselled crevice called the Cilician Gates, and the only way in which you could travel overland from Syria to the west was through this little narrow gap in the mountains. There was room for one wagon to pass. So Tarsus was the focal commercial centre. All the trade from the east, the overland trade, would come via Tarsus and pass up through the mountains towards the west. There was a magnificent artificial harbour there. It was the capital of the province. Julius Caesar visited it in 46 BC, and 5 years later Antony and Cleopatra had a rendezvous there. It was also a university city. The geographer Strabo tells us that its citizens were noted for the eagerness with which they pursued learning and culture. So it was a noted centre of Greek culture, some would say second only in the period to Alexandria. As a Greek city, it would have possessed a theatre and a stadium where the Greek tragedies and comedies would have been performed in the open air, and the sports of running, wrestling and chariot racing would have entertained the local people. Did Paul go to that theatre when he was a young man? It's an interesting question. Some commentators say absolutely not. He was a Pharisee. His parents would never have allowed him to attend a Greek theatre or to watch Greek sports. We do know Paul had a great affinity for the Greek sports. He's using them as metaphors. I'm not so sure that he wouldn't. Adolf Deichmann, discovered an inscription about this period at the city of Miletus, which tells us that there was a special section of theatre seats assigned to Jews. So some Jews at the period obviously were acquainted with the world of Greek drama and Greek sport. I have an open mind on the matter. I do feel that it is doubtful if Paul, as a child or a young boy, would have been permitted by his parents to attend these. As I'll say tomorrow, I think a more likely scenario is that after his conversion, when he returned to Tarsus, I believe there was a period of conscious preparation for ministry to the Greeks. And I think it's possible then that as a converted man, he acquainted himself with Greek literature, Greek drama, and Greek culture. But, I mean, that's only a supposition on my part. I just think it's difficult to imagine a pious Pharisee, a Hebrew of Hebrews, sending his children to watch naked men racing or wrestling in the arena. However, a cultural, commercial centre, a centre of education, an industrial centre, and the main industries which gave Tarsus its prosperity were the production of linen and the material called silicium. Obviously from the name of the province, Silicium. Silicium was a material of black goat's hair. It was waterproof and it was heat retaining. And it was used for tents and for other coverings which needed to be either waterproof or heat retaining. We read in Acts 18:3 that when Paul met Aquila and Priscilla at Corinth, because he was a tent maker, as they were, he stayed and worked with them. The Greek word skenopios does refer literally to a maker of tents, but I think almost certainly it has a wider meaning. It would be a manufacturer of these woolen goods from the native material, the black goat's hair of Silicium. Now, we know that Paul was able to work with his hands at this material, that he was able actually to make the tents with his own hands, but I think we shouldn't look upon him as simply an artisan. He was a citizen of Tarsus, Acts 21:39, and we know from archaeology that in order to be a citizen of Tarsus, you had to have property worth 500 drachmas. In other words, you had to be reasonably well off to be admitted to the role of citizens of Tarsus. So perhaps we should think of Paul as belonging to a well-to-do family in the upper levels of Tarsian society. It would seem that his father was a manufacturer of these woolen goods, perhaps employing several men. But in the light of that very valid and valuable Jewish requirement, he and his son could take part themselves with the men in the work. Every Jew, every pious Jew, had to be the master of a trade. He had to be able to earn his living with his own hands. It's a pity that's been lost from much of our educational process. In my case, it's not a pity, but theoretically, it's a pity. I guess it's a great blessing. I don't think we should think of Paul as perhaps brought up in a very poor background. There were many things which he considered loss for a knowledge of Christ Jesus as Lord. And his family seems to have been reasonably well off. We don't know how long he spent in Tarsus. We know that he studied in Jerusalem, but we don't know when he travelled there. He says in Acts 22:3, I was born in Tarsus of Cilicia, but brought up in this city. That is Jerusalem. The Greek word anatethramenos suggests brought up from a very early age. So he may have gone to Jerusalem as a small boy. On the other hand, his knowledge of Greek would seem to indicate a childhood spent in a Greek city. Machen says he uses the Greek language in such masterly fashion that he must have become familiar with it very early in his life. We simply don't know. He may well have spent the first 9 or 10 years of his life in Tarsus. Formative years, years which left an indelible stamp on his personality. It's also very probable that he spent a number of years as a grown man in his native city. It's almost certain that he never met Jesus. I would say it's certain. And I would conclude from that he was absent from Jerusalem during the years of the Lord's ministry. It's inconceivable to me that Saul, being the man he was, could have lived in Jerusalem as a Pharisee and never have seen and heard this notorious prophet face to face, the one about whom everyone was talking and the Pharisees were agitating, and here was a zealous, earnest Pharisee. If he'd been there, I think he'd have seen him and he would have met him. But whatever the details, and they're immaterial, we know that his debt to his native city was immense, for it almost made a Greek of him. He spoke the Greek language and wrote it with freedom and eloquence and power. As we'll see later, he was familiar with the Greek poets. He could quote them from memory. James Stewart says his very illustrations remind us that there was something in his nature that responded to the thrill of the Greek games and the prowess of runners and boxers. He writes of these things as one who had seen them and taken delight in them. Something in his nature which responded to the Greek world. He knew the Septuagint, the Greek translation of the Old Testament, and he was able to quote from memory large sections of the Word of God in Greek. Tarsus was a centre of Stoic philosophy, and there are some evidences in Paul's vocabulary and style and method of argument which are at least reminiscent of the Stoics. In other words, his place of birth and background had prepared him for his life's work. The gospel had to go to the Greeks, and Paul was ideally equipped to take it. He had had an exposure that, for example, Peter or James hadn't had. They couldn't identify as he could. God was preparing him in that way. Secondly, let's look for a moment at his Roman background. This was equally important because while the culture of the day was Greek, political and military power rested in Roman hands. You remember perhaps the occasion when Paul was in danger of a flogging, Acts 22:27, when he claimed Roman citizenship. And the garrison commander questioned him about it. The commander went to Paul and asked, "Tell me, are you a Roman citizen?" "I am," he answered. Then the commander said, "I had to pay a great price for my citizenship, but I was freeborn," Paul replied. So, in other words, his father was a Roman citizen. Paul was born a Roman citizen. Now, at this time, citizenship was a very, very rare privilege, seldom granted to non-Romans. That wasn't true 100 years later. The Roman citizenship became prostituted and they just spread it and spread it and spread it throughout the empire. But at this stage, it was rarely granted to non-Romans, and it was quite exceptional for it to be enjoyed by a Jew. A most remarkable and unusual thing, especially Jews such as Paul's family. They were not Romanizers. They were not trying to merge into pagan society. As we'll see in a moment, they were a strict Orthodox family, a family of Pharisees. We don't know how or when Paul's ancestors became Roman citizens. The only way would have been through some outstanding service to Rome. F.F. Bruce has a very interesting suggestion. He says in his book, The Apostle of the Free Spirit, a firm of tent makers could have been very useful to a fighting proconsul. That's quite an attractive suggestion. Some Roman general, some Roman proconsul needing military supplies on a campaign, and Paul's father or grandfather or great-grandfather was able to provide from the black goat's hair all his requirements. It's possible, we don't know. Some of his ancestors rendered a service to Rome and was rewarded with perpetual Roman citizenship for himself and his family. And never forget that Paul was a Roman citizen and that he had a three-barreled name. We only know the last one. His name would have been something like Marcus Aurelius Paulus. Every Roman had a nomen, a praenomen, and a cognomen, or a name, a prename, and a surname. And Paulus was his surname. In Roman circles, he would have been called by his full name. He would have had a full Roman status. He would have had a recognized identity. This citizenship gave him various rights and privileges. He was exempt from various ignominious forms of punishment. He had protection against summary execution. He couldn't be crucified, for example. Above all, he had the right of appeal to Rome. And doesn't it show you the marvellous complexity of God's sovereign plan? Years earlier, perhaps 50 years earlier, perhaps 70 years earlier, perhaps 100 years earlier, some obscure little Jewish tent maker, maybe, in Cilicia, had made a dozen tents for a Roman general. And the Roman general had been pleased and had said, I'll make you a citizen. And that happened so that many years later his descendant could say, I appeal to Caesar. And could go with the gospel of the cross to the capital city of the world and be received there as a citizen. Amazing, the great web and line of God's providence. A Roman citizen. Very, very rare privilege. And yet, as we see in the book of Acts, tremendously significant. And that brings us, thirdly, to his Jewish background. By far, the most important aspect of Paul the man. His natural and spiritual pedigree is given in Philippians 3:5. Circumcised the eighth day, of the people of Israel, of the tribe of Benjamin, a Hebrew of the Hebrews, in regard to the law, a Pharisee. That's a very, very strong statement. Nothing could be stronger. He is a Jew from the cradle. He's a Jew through and through. He's a Jew first, he's a Jew last, he's a Jew always. If you want to look at Paul, he says, at the very basis of everything is my Jewishness. Could we look briefly at three of those phrases? He was of the tribe of Benjamin. It was considered the most Jewish of all the tribes. In the territory of Benjamin were found the holy city and the temple. The most outstanding Benjaminite in Hebrew history was Saul, the first king of Israel. And it's certain that many of the young boys of the tribe of Benjamin were called Saul after their great tribal ancestor. So his pedigree is of the highest. Other Jews would say, oh, you're a Benjaminite. And that was at the very heart. That was the most Jewish of the tribes. He was also, he says, a Hebrew of the Hebrews. That's not just a cliche. It doesn't mean simply that his family was very Jewish. It is a technical expression. At this period, the word Hebrew had acquired a specific meaning. It was more limited than Jew. It was usually contrasted with the word, the Greek word, Hellenistis, Hellenist. That contrast is made very specific, for example, in Acts 6 1. There was a murmuring of the Hellenists towards the Hebrews. It seems to have been a linguistic and cultural distinction. A Hebrew used Aramaic as his normal mode of speech, and he attended a synagogue where the service was conducted in Hebrew. A Hellenist was a Jew who spoke Greek as his native tongue, and who attended a synagogue where the scriptures and prayers were in Greek. So that this was a linguistic and cultural difference between the Jews living outside Israel. Most of them were Hellenists, speaking Greek in the home, reading the scriptures in Greek, praying in Greek. Others were Hebrews, who, although they knew Greek, spoke Aramaic and worshipped God in Hebrew. Paul was born into an Aramaic-speaking home. Most dispersion Jews, as I've said, were Hellenists. And the Hebrews, among them, were either recent immigrants from Palestine who hadn't had time to change their ways, or families who were unusually strict in their religion and concerned to preserve Orthodox and Palestinian ways. I suppose you folks could identify it in your own society. I mean, if there's a community in New York that is speaking in a European language, they've either just got off the plane, or else they have some very, very pressing moral, religious, cultural reason. They're an unusually strict society. And that's the picture you should have. And I think it was the second of those. I don't think it was that Paul's family had just emigrated from Palestine. I think in the light of their Phariseeism, they were an Orthodox family, a strict family. And Paul was brought up with Aramaic as his mother tongue. You remember how in Acts 21 and 22, when he faced the lynch mob in Jerusalem, he said to them in Aramaic, "Brothers and fathers, listen now to my defense." When they heard him speak to them in Aramaic, they became very quiet. So Aramaic was Paul's mother's tongue. And isn't there tremendous beauty and significance in the fact that the risen Lord, when he spoke to him on the Damascus Road, we read in Acts 26:14, "I heard a voice saying to me in Aramaic, 'Saul, Saul, why do you persecute me?'" So Christ spoke to him in his mother tongue. A Hebrew of the Hebrews, a strict, Orthodox, Aramaic-speaking Jew. Thirdly, he is a Pharisee. Acts 23:6, "I am a Pharisee, the son of Pharisees." Huios Pharisaion, which the NIV bewilderingly translates the son of a Pharisee. Huios Pharisaion. The son of Pharisees. You say a son of a Pharisee, that's misleading. Maybe his father was the first Pharisee. Paul's not saying that. He says the son of generations of Pharisees. This isn't a new thing to our family. At least several generations. Now, we can't embark on a study of Pharisaism, but Paul's description of it is completely accurate. Acts 26:5. "According to the strictest sect of our religion, I lived as a Pharisee." He must have shown exceptional promise as a boy, because he was sent to Jerusalem to train under Gamaliel. Acts 22:3. "Under Gamaliel, I was thoroughly trained in the law of our fathers." We read later in Acts 23:16 of a married sister of Paul who lived in Jerusalem. So it's possible that the family had a home there. Again, we don't know. She may have been older than Paul. Perhaps he stayed with her. We do know that Gamaliel was one of the great Jewish rabbis. Acts 5:38 tells us that he was honoured by all the people. And he's regarded by the Jews as the last of the true Pharisees. The Jewish Mishnah comments sadly, when Rabban Gamaliel died, the glory of Torah ceased, and purity and separateness died. So he was the last great Pharisee. The two great schools of the day were the strict school of Shammai and the more lenient school of Hillel. Shammai, Shammai, Hillel, Hillel. And one tradition has Gamaliel as a successor of Hillel. Some say even a son or grandson of Hillel, the great liberal rabbi. Several points in Paul's teaching, however, suggest that he favoured a stricter view than perhaps was taught by Gamaliel. The school of Shammai, for example, taught that one breach of the law was a breach of the whole law. The school of Hillel taught that it was a matter of pluses and minuses. If you kept more commandments than you broke, your spiritual account was in the black and you were all right. It's quite clear, for example, that Paul, Galatians 5:3, and James 2:10, both shared what we might say was the Shammite view of the law. Whosoever breaks the law in one point is guilty of all. Now, we don't know whether Gamaliel taught this stricter view to Paul, or whether Paul simply disagreed with his teacher. Not unknown for men to disagree with their teacher. He certainly disagreed with Gamaliel over the policy to be adopted towards the Christians. You remember Gamaliel's laissez-faire policy recorded, isn't it, in Acts 5, 38-39, leave these men alone. If their purpose or activity is from men, it will fail. But if it is from God, you will not be able to stop these men. At any rate, he sat under Gamaliel, and from Gamaliel learned what was best and finest and noblest in his people's tradition and history. There's a novelist, he's an American writer, I presume his novels are still in print over here, whom I have found interesting to read, a man called Chaim Potok. Does that ring a bell with any of you? He's a New York Hasidic Jew, at least that was his background. And he's written a number of novels, The Promise, The Chosen, The Inheritance, and so on, telling of his upbringing in New York among the Hasidic Jews, and how he learned Torah each day, and so on and so forth. Fictional accounts. Those novels are very, very well worth reading, because they gave me an insight, at least, into what it was like. He tells of sitting down with his father and learning the Hebrew and learning to read it, and the Hebrew without the pointing, and then all the commentaries and all the rabbis and the minute attention that was given to all this. And I found Potok's writing, although he's writing of the 60s and 70s, very interesting as an insight into the sort of thing that Paul would have been exposed to.
One of those, Ted, was made into a movie, The Chosen.
Who was it?
I've referred to one of the moving incidents.
Oh, really?
So
oh, really?
If that ever comes around again, The Chosen is in a film.
Oh, that's interesting. They're worth seeing.
Yes.
Yes. Well, it would give us a sort of an updated picture of Paul's training. His mind would be saturated with the Old Testament. He would be filled with reverence for the law. The rabbis taught him to debate. They taught him to set forth a case in a logical and persuasive manner. They taught him to anticipate objections and to answer objections. And many of the things that you see in Paul were from his Jewish training. He argues and preaches and teaches as a real Jew. He received the finest education possible in the ancient world. His intellectual gifts, his theological gifts, were honed to a pitch of perfection He himself says in Galatians 1:14, I was advancing beyond many Jews of my own age and was extremely zealous for the traditions of my fathers. So he was one of the coming men among the Jews, one of their stars, one of their real theologians and preachers and debaters. Saul was in the honors class. He was in the very, very front rank. You couldn't imagine a finer training for a future missionary and apologete and theologian and preacher. So you see how God was weaving all the threads together. The Greek language, the Greek culture, the familiarity with the whole Mediterranean lifestyle, the Roman citizenship and identity and protection, the intense Jewishness, the understanding of the Old Testament, the sympathy for Israel and for God's dealings with his people. God was weaving all these threads into a pattern. Paul didn't yet know God, but God knew him. And God was preparing him for his life's work. His Roman citizenship is going to facilitate his missionary activity. The trade which he's learning will provide him with a means of support. He'll always be able to provide a square meal for himself. And his body is being rendered capable of prolonged physical effort. In other words, the man is a fit man. All that is part of God's preparation. His Greek background will enable him to communicate with the Gentiles. And his Jewish upbringing and education are preparing him, laying down those logs of truth which will prepare him to teach the faith. God is already shaping his servant for a precise place in his great plan. Paul is being drawn with cords of love to that crucial moment on the Damascus Road. And as he thinks back as a Christian over his early life, he's amazed. He says, I see God's hand in it all. God's plan and God's leading. And every step may seem to lead further away from Christ, but in reality, it's leading him closer to Christ. Now, in application of that, there are two things I want to say. And the first is that what is true of Paul is equally true of every child of God. We just happen to have the data available to us here to see it in Paul's life. We don't yet know the end of our own lives. We haven't an authoritative, infallible commentary on our own lives. That is hidden from us. But we can read about Paul and we can marvel and say, look at all those things that were happening. He didn't know why they were happening. But later on he knew. Why did he learn Greek? Why was he a Roman citizen? Why was he sent to Gamaliel? Didn't know about anything about that. No choice, no planning on a human level, but it all fitted together. And as I say, that's true of all of us. Everything that has happened to us has been under the sovereign overruling and control of God. There's a sort of a pattern in much fundamentalism that when you become a Christian, you just completely wipe out everything that has happened to you before. It is of no significance. It is of no meaning. It is of no importance. I was in the darkness and ignorance of sin. That's not a biblical view. Because the biblical view is deeper than that. That even in spite of myself, and even what I was fighting against, God made no mistakes. You see, think of the typical evangelical testimony. We had a girl from Cyprus who was converted and came to Ireland, and somebody sniffed out the fact that she had an amazing testimony. And I knew that girl's testimony. Her father had beaten her with an iron bar for her faith to Christ. He'd taken an iron bar and beaten her. He took her out of church one day and beat her with a chain in the street. Her parents hid her clothes on a Saturday evening so that she would have no clothes to go to church on the next Lord's Day. Tremendous story. And somebody asked that girl to give her testimony at a meeting. And she could have got onto the evangelical lecture circuit and been a tremendous hit. And the girl looked at me and she said, "But I love my parents." You see what she was saying? And she wasn't going to go and stand and display. I know there's a place for godly testimony. I'm not denying that. She wasn't going to stand and, as it were, show the sins of her father and her mother, for whose conversion she was still praying. God didn't make any mistakes, she said, when he put me in that home. God didn't give me the wrong parents. And it cost her to say that, for she hadn't had a happy home. But she saw God's providence in it. And she said, "For everything that happened to me, there was a reason." And some of you today may have bad experiences. Things that you look back on with great grief and sorrow, as Paul did. Was there ever anybody who looked back with greater grief and sorrow than Paul? And yet in it all, he said, there was a purpose, and there was a preparation, and there was an overruling. And I think it's profitable for us to sit down occasionally, as Paul did, and look back over our lives and say, why did this happen? And what relevance has it for today and tomorrow? Why have I known what it was to be drunk? Do I just wipe that out of my consciousness? Or do I say, does God want me to do something with that? Is there a compassion? Is there an understanding? Is there a day going to come when I can put my arm round a brother and say, or a man and say, I know, I've been there. So for everything, you see, we can use it. And God was guiding and God was planning. And I think we're moved to worship as we look at Paul and see what God was doing. But then we've got to bring it up to our own lives and see a similar pattern of preparation and equipment for service. For God has shaped each one of us precisely for the niche that he has for us. Right, we'll take a break there.